Carol Frazier.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you here. I loved what I read about you. I was like, once I saw 25 years as an HR consultant, I was like, damn it. Here I was thinking I was seasoned and I knew what I was doing. And then I saw 25 years. I'm like, I have so much to talk to her about.
Ask me anything.
Welcome to HR Sucks, a show on a mission to change the way the world thinks about HR by discussing the real problems companies face that lead to high employee disengagement and low profitability. I'm Katrina Gazarian, CEO, mom, and your host. My most important claim to fame, being voted funniest in fifth grade. That's right. Once upon a time, I used to be funny, and then I got into HR. A lot of shows talk about how important company culture is, but no one is telling you how to do it, and that's what I'm here for. Let's get started.
So you've been consulting. So this isn't really being in HR for 25 years. You've been consulting, like fractional HR consulting, running a firm for 25 years. And I want to know from your perspective, what were like the key eras or like key reinventions of HR over the last 25 years, if you can summarize that for us?
So, I mean, I've been doing this since 1991. So I've been doing it actually for, this will be my 34th year doing HR. So to say that I started out in personnel is the truth. And how it's evolved to where we are today, the list of changes is exponential. It's really a matter of how has business evolved and thereby how much has HR actually been able to keep up. Because we've gone from administrative to at least opening the door to strategic, like going from administrative to more of a business partner. We have taken everything was in paper and now there's technology, right? And then you've got socioeconomic changes in each one of these decades that drives where our focuses are. So is it DEIB? Is it wellness? Is it data analytics? Is it valuing people in the gig economy, right? Like, so the shifts of how we are focusing on individuals changes with each shift of priorities that are happening societally. Overall, I can honestly say, in 33 years, we are seen as a more valuable asset in a business than before. We are all still very challenged in telling people the value that we bring because it's not something that is directly quantifiable. And unless you are a CEO or an owner or a leader who understands and recognizes that people are the success of your organization. If you can do your job and you can run your business without people, I totally get why you don't see the value of HR. But if you have humans to do things, then you need the human focused individual to help you with your bottom line. One of the shifts that I've been pushing myself is the continued evolution of HR. So COVID did us a really good solid, first off. I want to thank COVID for what it did for human resources. As stressful as it has been, it really put us to the forefront. So we have a greater voice than we've ever had before. What we've seen, though, is what's happening with human beings in general since COVID. Since the massive shifts that we've been seeing over the last 4 years, 5 years, and what we are up against going to the future is helping people who are currently in HR or even moving into HR, how to shift from a business partner to a human behaviorist, understanding more about the people, what makes them tick, the, you know, neuroscience, if you will, the holistic human being. And then because my job is for a business outcome, having more in-depth and breadth knowledge in that area, and then how I can direct it to impact someone's business. And I think when we as a practice, and this isn't, that's, I love that word, because just like lawyers, just like doctors, HR is a practice. Finance isn't a practice. Operations isn't a practice. IT isn't a practice. The reason HR is a practice is because it deals with the humans who are always evolving. So we as human resources need to be on top of human evolution and not get pulled down all the time into administrative. I'm a big believer of strong foundations, which is administrative and operations, if you will. But the next generation is, you know, take time to learn about human behavior, about the human mind, about the human motivations. Take time to, you don't need to go off and spend $15,000 and become a certified coach, but learning coaching principles and how to apply coaching principles as an HR practitioner. We're not the therapist. So if you are a coach out there and you're listening, you know, if you're an ICF coach, we don't do therapy. We do coaching. And it's about inquiry. It's about positive inquiry. It's about exploration inquiry. It's about uncovering the human drivers innately. So I'd say what we've seen kind of the evolution over 33 years has been supported through technology, has been supported through education. I mean, when I graduated college, we didn't have a degree in human resources. Mm-hmm. So right. You can now actually go get some of these things. But I also see that we are continuing to have to ebb and flow faster than ever before. And the skills of human behavior, coaching principles, neuroscience is going to be super helpful in elevating us or accelerating us to becoming and maintaining the relevance in the boardroom.
I think it's so interesting you say that. I mean, you said so much in just 5 minutes. Going back to, so you've been in HR for 33 years. You've had your practice for about 25 years. Just really quick, so there's some context behind why you maybe left kind of this traditional HR role and went into a consulting firm. Give us a little bit of context of why that happened, and then I have some more questions.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not monumental. It was 9/11. You know, 9/11 happened, and I was working for a very large advertising firm, advertising marketing. I was the head of employee relations. So I was this kind of like second or third in charge, and they had just gone public. And my sole job, once about a year into it, was to lay off about 480 people. So it was a LIFO, last in, first out. And I was one of those people. And so once that happened, for anybody who's been around as long as I have, back then the SHRM job board was like a really good place to go to find a job. Right after 9/11, that thing went blank. There was nothing. Nobody was hiring. And people still needed support. So I quickly pivoted. I incorporated. And I started calling my network and going, I knew you had a job open. What is it you needed done? And they're like, well, we need this or we need that. And I said, why don't you just hire me as a consultant and I'll get that subject done or that project done. And that's what I did for a period of about 3 years, fruitful. My ex-husband, who's a technologist, it's going to sound weird where we are today. He developed kind of YouTube before it was YouTube. And so we actually partnered with a bunch of entertainment companies, and he brought that technology to like directors of photography or agents of directors and actors. And we were able to create online reels basically, as opposed to creating VHSs or DVDs. And what that did was I still had half a dozen people who I was what we're now calling fractional. I had about a half a dozen small businesses that were utilizing me. And then we were working on technology. And then it opened a gateway up for me to get into bigger companies. So then I actually had a great project doing performance management rollout with Disney. I had a great project with Sony Pictures with two other people who were creating the worldwide marketing group. And so we were doing all of the workforce planning. And then I had a big company, GfK Market Research, where I was doing all their compensation. So, you know, it was like big meaty ones. And so it started to evolve. And that's what really allowed me to stay in the consulting realm. And the only time that I had to take a little bit of a segue and I went back to being a CHRO for about 4 years was when I got the divorce and I had to kind of close out the business. And so I went back to being a W-2 and then I reincorporated as C4 Talent.
Thank you for sharing that. And you're in New York, correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I just wanted to provide that context of why 9/11 was so, why that impacted you in a much bigger way than I would say it did for us in Southern California in right. terms of jobs. You talked about how your company is really focused on the business objectives and this reminds me of like a gap that we're seeing in HR generally is you have HR who is very transactional, keeping, you know, the company out of the courtroom, so on and so forth. And then you have this small percentage of really great HR. They can get any job, CHRO, CPO job that they want because they understood and they've learned how to connect what they do to the business outcomes in a bigger way. And we're talking revenue, profitability, EBITDA, things like that, where we're not seeing these numbers being talked about within the HR departments, I would say on a much larger scale. Right. These conversations are not happening as much as they should be happening, where HR can continue to retain their value. When you talked about neuroscience and human behavior, it reminds me of, I love this like line, and I've even used this line, but one of my favorite lines in HR is you can only be as good in HR to the extent that you're willing to heal. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about, you know, you need to learn about human behavior. You need to learn about what motivates your employees. And I'm like, well, you need to figure out how to do that for yourself too. And then
very
once
true.
You go through that process of learning and how you're healing and how you're moving through life and what motivates you and what your core values are and what alignment looks like to you, because you've done this before, you've experienced this before, it makes you more equipped to help other employees, your stakeholders, and within your department to get there as well.
Yep.
There is a fine line. I agree with you with therapy being, you know, offering therapeutic advice versus advice that is strictly, you know, from the professional realm. When, if for any HR leaders that are listening and you're saying you need to learn these things, you need to figure out and educate yourself on these topics, how do they do that? Can you share, like, if I'm listening, I'm an HR leader, where do I start? How do I figure that out?
So you said so many things I also want to touch on, though, if that's okay. So one of the things that you mentioned is, and then I'll get back to where to find, you know, learning coaching principles, learning about human behavior. But one of the things you mentioned was around the business acumen. And one of the things that I've been able to offer as a fractional is the fact that I have run my own business. I mean, I've got CEOs and founders who I'm counseling on so many things outside of human resources. And that's just because I've gone through the trials and tribulations of making mistakes. So please take advantage of my mistakes. I'm happy to give you the advice, right? You can still do that while being an in-house HR person. It's really a matter of asking for mentorship, possibly, if you can't get at the table, right? I don't know. I mean, again, I've been doing this a very long time. And every time I've seen myself or my colleagues tap a CFO on the shoulder, tap a COO on the shoulder, and ask for the opportunity to learn, I know that there are people out there who would say, shoo, 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 but I have yet to really see that happen. I think anybody who is honestly and authentically curious and recognizes that it's going to benefit them to learn that, that person's going to want to teach them. It's going to make that person's job even that much easier. So I encourage, from a business acumen standpoint, if you want to get an MBA, again, I'm a big fan of education. I got a lot of certs and a lot of degrees. I will tell you, though, that boots on the ground, real world training is very different than academic training. So it's a matter of read what you can, listen to podcasts, get a mentor, get a coach, whatever you want that's going to help you help teach you some of these key things. You don't need to know everything. You don't need to be a CFO. You don't need to be a COO. But it is important to understand the concepts and what your role as HR is in that puzzle. And so I wanted just to touch on that because I think you're absolutely right in that that is an area for opportunity for HR professionals. Now, as it goes to human behavior and dealing with one's own trauma, as a certified coach, when I am coaching HR people, when I talk to them and explain to them, even though we're going to be focusing on you and your growth and identifying your blockers and identifying the values you want to lean into, recognize that everything you're going through is exactly what you can bring as an HR professional to your organization. So even though I'd been coaching for, I don't know, 20 years, I took the time to go through a certification process only because it was necessary now. Back then it wasn't. Now It's like you have to be ICF certified. And I'm like, okay, I better not, you know, cut my nose off to spite my face. But if I wanted to have a coaching practice. But the idea here is it's just like anything. They break you down and they build you back up. And so going through a group coaching or an individual coaching, going through, if you have somebody who really understands the coaching principles and isn't calling themselves a coach, but really what they're doing is giving you advice. So there's a little graphic I have over here that's got all this Venn diagram. And it's not consulting, it's not mentoring, it's not therapy, it's not training, it's not teaching, it's not counseling, and it's coaching. There's a difference. If you can really find somebody who's going to work with you as a coach and teach you what that feels like, then when you go and bring that to your organization, you can parlay that experience and build your own way of approaching it. Again, do I think everybody needs to be a coach? That's a big fat no. I think you should understand coaching principles, which many HR people do, but we fall prey to wanting to answer the question as opposed to helping others seek the answer to the question. So to find a coach that works with you, somebody who you can connect with, even if now it's in a group where you can connect with multiple people, feeling all of that growth together, there are programs out there that are not very expensive. Not everything needs to be a $10,000 mastermind, you know, program. There are people offering things for much less, and you can learn tools. Every tool in the toolbox is a helpful tool. It doesn't necessarily have to be the biggest tool or the sharpest tool, because sometimes a rubber mallet does just the trick instead of having to have a metal hammer, right? So you just need to kind of understand the tools that you'll need for your role, for the role that you play within your organization. But you're not wrong. In fact, I love you for saying it. Going through the process yourself is going to give you that experience, not the book smart, but the experience to know what it feels like so that you have a stronger curiosity, a stronger empathy when you are bringing that particular skill to your people.
Let's just say, you know, leaders who are listening are like, I don't know about coaching, you know, social media kind of ruined coaching for me, so on and so forth, whatever excuses or blocks they may have around it. If you could recommend one book or one podcast or, you know, one, you know, something quick that they can get in their hands or listen to, what would be the first place you would send somebody?
I think the Mel Robbins podcast is a good place. She touches on some very deep emotions in very quick ways. And she's very vulnerable. So she herself is talking about her journey and how it's helped her. And then her guests are bringing their vulnerable journeys forward. As far as a book goes, God, there's so many. One of them that I know people are going to maybe give me a little snub on, but I loved Love as a Business Strategy. Mm-hmm. And I just understanding that the CEO and the leaders were fallible, their business was going under, there needed to be a moment of clarity. And it was through that opportunity to really look in the mirror and look at what was causing the downfall of their organization that they were able to get the courage to try something new. Both of those, the Mel Robbins and Love as a Business Strategy, lean into my coaching practice. So I can only speak, obviously, most intelligently for my own practices, but I utilize a lot of the moments that touch me, and I bring that as part of my toolbox when I'm helping HR professionals. I'm a book listener. I'm not necessarily a reader. I listen to a lot of books. When I was in the car listening to that, it was eye-opening. And I wished I wasn't driving so I could sit there and write notes or highlight it, you know, because there are moments where you're able to really think, oh shit, well, that happens to me at work. Like I could have tried that approach. That approach that each one of those components are talking about is exploration, curiosity, empathy. Those are paramount in coaching. What they don't necessarily offer, though, is how do you ask the questions? The how you ask the question is the key to helping unlock blockers. We all know from just interviewing, right? You don't ask yes or no questions. You ask open-ended questions. There's a component of open-ended questioning within coaching, but it is different than what you see in your basic interview skills. So those are just some things that I would say, if you've got time, listen to that podcast or read that book. You might find a little bit within yourself to go, maybe I should explore more, and maybe there is something for me to do within coaching.
That reminds me of, you know, when you were just talking about questions and how to ask questions. One of my favorite books is Loving What Is by Byron Katie. And it really challenges your stories, the stories that you have attachment to, the stories that you have about other people and yourself, and that causes emotions that aren't positive. And I've taken this question in all aspects of my life, from coaching kids sports to parenting to work, and it's always, do you know this to be absolutely true? And it really, for me, is just a way for them to at least stop and think, you know, like, is this actually true? Is this, do I have the data to support that this is true? Whether it's a story about themselves or someone else or about the world at large, rather than, you know, I'm writing a book right now, and part one, I have an area called the HR know-it-all. And it's the HR professional or HR leader that gives advice about everything to everyone, despite them not having experience in this area or being an expert in this area. And I go in and talk about how this creates very toxic relationships in the workplace. Like if they don't take your advice and taking it personal, and you know, it's about a relationship and you're saying, leave him, you know, just you know what I'm talking about. Sure you've come across those. And in coaching, it's less about telling them what to do and more about helping them discover what it is they want to do and what path is going to be the best path for them to get there. But it's really just them figuring it out.
Yeah. One of the areas that you had actually talked about was figuring out what you value, right? And what your beliefs are. One of the exercises that I've adopted through my experiences, and I usually do it within the first session, is a values exercise. And in doing this values exercise, once you choose your values, right, you need to then tell me a time when you experienced those values so that you can tell your brain, go back and recall what that looked like, what it sounded like, and what it felt like. There hasn't been a moment yet in my coaching career where, as I'm listening to people, you ask that question three times, they have to come up with three examples, mm-hmm. where people are telling me their values because they didn't experience that value. So what that tells you is that the value that they're choosing, communications, trust, honesty, the stories that they align with those values is the absence of communications, trust, honesty, which means that you've chosen values that are based in trauma. Mm. You actually haven't chosen values that are going to drive your brain to where you ultimately want to be. And so we go through that exercise. And when we start talking about, well, what would that look like then, right? And what would you want to have done in those past situations? So then, you know, that's just a whole coaching thing. But more times than not, we as a human race are desiring of things. And we say that that's what I value because I desire it. So even myself, I had to shift my values. I had to, what are the aspirational values that I want? Curiosity, you know? Inspiration. Those are values. I want to inspire people, right? And I'm going to do that. And this is what's going to look like. And this is where I was inspired. And I'm able to find that positive memory. And that's where I would say, you know, for your listeners, if you're ever thinking about your values, ask yourself, tell me a time where you experienced that and see if you can find three solid things that are not negative in its foundation, that it's not something that was missing, but rather it's something you truly experienced.
Okay. So by the time this episode comes out, I would have the podcast where I go into values, how to find your core values, how to define them, how to create guiding principles, so on and so forth, would have come out already. So if y'all listen to that episode, take this nugget and go back and listen to that episode again as a tool to help, you know, craft your values and understand what your values are. Carol, I could talk about values all day, girl. It is my love language. I know all my values by heart. I know how to define them. I know all the guiding principles of them. I use them as my filter for making decisions. I measure myself on the demonstration of these values. I could go all day, girl. I love values. It has been the roadmap back to myself. Yep. True. I say this with as much heart as possible. When you know your values, when you know how you're defining those values, and you know the principles with those values, anytime you feel misaligned or anytime you feel like something is wrong, this is the roadmap back to yourself. Yep. And so once you said values, I mean, it was almost like you saying, you know, porterhouse steak, because I love it. I love it. The other day, I saw a repost from you discussing the chief people officer role and how it's just gotten so big, and yet HR teams are often understaffed. You indicated a certain ratio in regards to the finance teams, you know, as comparison. I've heard various ratios over time, one full-time HR role for every 50 employees, for example. What is your hot take on this, and why do you believe companies continue to understaff their HR functions?
So I'll come from a potentially positive front, and I'll say they just don't know what they just don't know. So the ratios, it's important to understand. So there was a place called the Saratoga Institute years and years and years ago. And they're the ones that did probably the most famous, if not the first, but definitely most famous study around ratios for human resources, amongst other things. Way back when, it was 1 to every 100, right? And this was before the HR business partner model. And what we have to remember was that was like 30, 40 years ago. And a lot's changed in 30, 40 years. And many times we hear, well, that can be automated, right? Technology can take care of that. You're not wrong. However, I think your listeners will probably say, we don't get nearly the number of investment dollars for technology to automate some of these more mundane tasks. So the 1 in 50 that you've kind of references, I think is a way to kind of move the needle to maybe try to create some positive movement. But some statistics, and I'll just let you know, if you were to look at the ratios for finance or IT, it's 1 to 30. And so why are we 1 to 50 or 1 to 100 when finance and IT are 1 to 30? Operations is a little bit harder because that varies by industry. Because if you've got a very, like if you've got a distribution industry, or if you've got a tech industry, or if you've got a retail industry, each one of those is going to have very different types of operations. So it's hard to really quantify that ratio. But when you think about finance, IT, and HR, there are components that are pretty easily measurable and able to understand that kind of ratio. I would say, I'm actually in the midst of writing an article about this, because I've actually spent time looking into, like, who on their stupid mind's going to know what the ratio is for finance and IT? Somebody like me. So it's a matter of understanding that, one, they've always said finance and IT are super complex. Not disagreeing. However, over the last 7 years, HR has become just as, if not more, complex. And more responsibilities are falling to the people function, and yet they're not increasing the headcount for that increase in responsibility. Two, I have now researched that there are at least, and I'm sure I'm missing some, 26 specific certifications a person can get in human resources. And I know that there are things that people do that aren't even certified yet. So just imagine 26 different specialties, right? Complexities within human resources. Nobody's asking a finance person to know all of their different certifications, and half of them don't even have certifications, but all their different functions, right? Same thing with IT, front-end developer, back-end developer, like you name it, you're going to have different specialists to be able to give your employees what they need. So if we were to recognize finally that the HR function is way more complex than it's ever been, that it actually is equal or rivals the complexity of other roles within your organization that you always hire many people for, then trying to find a different metric is needed nowadays. So you can look at it from two different columns. What is my ratio if I actually am tech enabled? And then what is my ratio if I'm not tech enabled? And then what are the buckets or groupings of responsibilities that every organization has to have, and recognizing that those are distinct and different from each other. So you've got your basic HR, which is your payroll, compliance, admin-focused HR. If you are tech-enabled, you could probably have 1 to 150 employees. But if you are not tech enabled, that's going to be cut in half, like 1 to 75. Then your second function, your standard HR, you've got your talent acquisition, employee relations, benefits administration, and some component of HRBP. If you're tech enabled, 1 to 100. If you're not, cut it in half, 1 to 50. Then you have your strategic HR. So now this is your HRBP themselves, your L&D, your people analytics, your OD, right? If you're tech enabled, that is 1 to 75. And then if you're not tech enabled, it's 1 to 30. Then if you get into the other bigger buckets, like the more strategic buckets around, you know, a very complex organization like tech or healthcare or union workforces or global, that usually has some component to it that may need an additional person, even if that additional person is fractional, right? And then you have the other side of it, which is high growth, your startups, right? Somebody who knows the AI and is going to be able to find the right people and motivate the right people. That could be another function. But let's just look at what I said. That's the minimum of three for a 75-person company. Let's just look at it that way. You need, if you have 75 employees, you need a minimum of three. And this is through, and it's easy to find the data. It's just that we're not willing to recognize that there are competencies, there are skills, there are responsibilities that you want to hold people accountable to. And no one human can do all of that because each of it takes time and there's only so many hours in the day.
I also, just in my experience with our portfolio of companies, you know, we've in the last 9 years, we've serviced over 100 companies at this point. And, you know, we come in, I'm sure it's similar to yours. We come in, we audit their HR operations. We look at compliance, recruiting and selection, employee communications, professional development, compensation and benefits. And I've realized that they actually don't even realize that their HR function is subpar because they don't know what success looks like. It's challenging in that it's hard to get leaders who are not HR to understand what you're saying because they're just uneducated about the potential of HR when it's done right and how HR... And I know earlier you were saying that, you know, we don't, HR maybe doesn't have a direct correlation to, you know, business outcomes or business longevity. But I'm like, listen, if I came on board and your EBITDA increased or your profitability increased, it's because of the work I did.
Yep.
Because whether you want to chalk it to sales or marketing or finance or operations, those are people. And if those people are producing good work and they're happy and they're innovative and they're engaged, that is a function of HR.
Yeah. A good HR. It's a function of a good HR. It's a function good of HR. An HR who understands that communications, awareness, collaboration, training, support is necessary for an increase in productivity, an increase in engagement, which, you know, everybody says this word, increase engagement. And I'm like, guys, do you want your people to be so in love with what they're doing that they put in the extra 5-6 hours a week because they just love what they're doing? That's engagement. That's the increase in productivity. You know, you call us, we all know everybody's involved in culture, but yet you put the onus on HR. And if you want to put the onus on me, half the time, there are a lot of people out there going, it's the leader's job. It's the leader's job. You're absolutely right. I'm happy to enable them through my display of what does culture look like. And if I can give them the example from which to reference, then I am happy to say, I'll take the lead. I'm a leader. I'll take the lead on this. I'll bring you along with me, though, because when you know that you are improving culture, the outcomes have been quantifiable. When your culture is healthy, your productivity is high, your EBITDA is high, your turnover is low, your succession, your opportunity to scale is high because you do not have to lose IP and try to continually be retraining people to get back up to that level of IP. It is quantifiable to your bottom line. And if you would like to have the human behaviorist lead your culture initiatives so that you can see the impact to your bottom line, again, happy to be the leader of the team, but it is a team project. But you're right. They don't know. They really don't know. And it's even as a business owner and I'm doing my pitches, listening to business owners, you know, have nobody, or they're outsourcing and getting, you know, 10 hours a week from, or 10 hours a month from somebody to do their payroll processing. And they're begging, they're hungry for proactive, involved HR. And then I go, great. So you've been spending $1,800 a month, so $20,000 a year. And I'm going to walk in and tell you, you have to spend six figures. Mm-hmm. You're going to freak out. But the idea is, you wouldn't have called me if it was working. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have thought, I know what I'm doing. And, you know, everything that I'm doing is all that needs to be done. You didn't make the phone call because you were feeling good about yourself. You made the phone call because you knew you were missing something. So when the experts come in and do their audits, we have a 10-point audit. So when we come in and do a 10-point audit and we tell you where you're red, yellow, green, then we're telling you where you can improve your bottom line. Period, end of story. And I think that this is, if you're an internal HR person, do an annual audit of yourself and help your people recognize the investment you need so that you can get to that lower ratio and you have some tech enablement and you can get the right people in. Even if you even get them in as a consultant or as a fractional, your audit can help you make the argument, we're lagging in compensation, or we're lagging in learning and development. Let's get a consultant in for a period of time to at least build a foundation from which we can build. Mm-hmm.
We've been having a lot of conversations with leaders outside of HR, and, you know, we obviously burnout has become a hot topic. And people are defining it in different ways, and they have their own takes on it. And I love reading about stories of people coming out of burnout. And one of the conversation topics that we talk about with leaders that have to do with engagement is, what are your hobbies and passions? And ensuring that they're making time to do that. And it's not just, we, you know, doing another thing or adding another thing to their plate, but it's actually asking the question of, what do you need to stop doing in order to have time for these things? And the reason why I'm transitioning to this is because I've seen this uptick in bridging various art forms with leadership development workshops, from using Legos, writing songs. There must be some data out there about this relationship. And I've struggled to help leaders understand that having a hobby and a passion and putting time toward that is not a chore. Mm. It actually makes you more innovative to take your mind off the ball for a while. Yep. And come up with new ways and new portals of thinking about things. Tell me about Dancing Leaders. I saw this on your website. I read a testimonial from a CEO who was like, I was just happy not to have to lead something for once. Yep. Where did it stem from? And what types of results are your clients experiencing after these types of sessions? But I want to start with the data because I know you're a data nerd. So start with that.
So the data, I mean, there actually have been some really great scientific studies done. There was a really good one out of Germany, out of Berlin. And there was a recent one that was done actually here in New York. And the all of these programs, they can kind of be bucketed. You know, you've got your experiential kind of adventure-based learnings. Like if you get your team together to go ziplining, or you go into like, what are those called? Escape rooms, or like some sort of simulation, right? Then there's the problem solving ones like the Legos, right? Or building bridges with straws. And then there's the art-based forms, which is the dancing or the music or things that are creatively expressive, right? So the data that has been coming out of scientific studies, but also out of people's own experiences with, there's lots of companies that do the problem solving and the experiential. The Dancing Leaders is, I'm very happy to say, first. At this time, and I did my research, but I'm always open to hear more, I have not found anybody who is doing a dancing component with leadership and team building. And what the outcomes have shown is improvement in executive functioning, enhanced emotional intelligence skills, improved cognition, the improved self-confidence, the enhanced adaptability. One of the things that is out there is doing improv, right? Improv for leadership. So dancing has the component of improvisation skills. It has the emotional intelligence, so the nonverbal, the social awareness component. It also helps to improve presence. It improves a stronger leader-follower dynamic for your teams. And as you touched on, it improves the creativity and innovation. And the science behind that last one is really what I really hope to bring more to with the dancing leaders. So we have our, and I'm going to use my lovely layman terms, because when I'm talking to organizations, I don't want to get too scientific. So we've got our lizard brain, right? We've got the fight, flight, freeze, and we've got our overly analytic brain, the one that's sitting there doing all this, you know, heavy duty data. The middle brain is where your innovation and creativity lies. When you are doing a creative activity and you have the opportunity to work in an environment where someone is supporting you, planting seeds, watching you to figure out what are those unseen blockers, what are those unseen challenges that are opening up in a creative environment, we've been able to correlate scientifically exactly where you're feeling that and where you're having challenges at work, in your leadership style, in your team, in your processes. We've been able to link that. So the one thing that dancing leaders, so I have been dancing my whole life since I was 3 years old. I have been teaching swing dancing for 26 years. And this came out of something I recognized about 2016, 2017 was when I was teaching people how to dance, and when I was teaching people at the office, messages were very, very similar. And I was like, that's something to point out. So I started doing some research. There's people who've done TED Talks about movement. And so I started doing some research, and I had done about half a dozen sessions pre-COVID, and then COVID hit. And so I had to shelve it for a while. And I pulled it back out last year after I had done a couple of sessions, one of which was with an architecture firm. And it was that quote from that CEO sparked a 2-hour conversation after the sessions about his leadership style, about the way his team communicates, about the way he actually sees others in the organization as potential non-title leaders. The program itself is not a 30-minute program. It is a day-long session because, as we all know, to sit at, you know, one, there's no PowerPoint presentation and there's no handbook that you're, you know, or workbook that you're writing things down. This is experiential. This is embodiment learning. And what we've seen out of it is an immediate connection with your team, with yourself, with your communication style. I mean, look, I'm certified in DISC, Predictive Index, all these other assessments, and they're all going to come and tell you these things. I use those as tools in my mental toolbox to be able to help articulate some of these things. But when your body, and we know this, right? You said about your values, whenever it starts to not feel right, you go back to your values. That's your litmus test. That's where your core is. When you're dancing, and I specifically chose partner dancing, I'll get into that in a minute, but when you're dancing, your body is a part of your mind. And it is through that connection, that mind-body connection, that you're able to uncover much more faster than ever before. So the outcomes, as you see, are huge. Dr. Blumen, who did the study here in New York, she and I have had conversations. And I'm actually going to be working with her on her study. And then I'm bringing my own hypothesis that she's helping me with. So we're looking at this from both short-term and long-term impacts, because there is a wellness component to it. And her area is focused on dementia, and my area is focused on potential future dementia. The prolonged stress that we have all been under, what is the impact to one's cognitive abilities, short and long term? Even if you don't have the proclivity to have dementia, if you sit in a prolonged stress for 3, 5, 10 years, and let's face it, we're on that path right now, what is that doing for us in the future? What is that doing for our ability to be able to contribute and for ourselves, to society, to whoever? And is this cognitive decline going to be happening faster, sooner than what we've seen historically? So that's my hypothesis. And that's what I hope to prove, is that prolonged stress, which is a reason to hire better HR people and focus on wellness and focus on learning and development. It's just going to be a great study for all of us HR people. But the reason why I chose partner dancing is the neurological aspects of touch and movement in unison and the ability to lead movement with confidence and follow movement with curiosity. All of that plays in. So it has got a scientific backing. But one thing I can say from a fun perspective, at the end of the day, you're going to know enough dance moves that when a swing song comes on, you're going to be able to dance to it too.
So at fun.
Least you can walk out going, I learned how to swing dance.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else.
Yes, exactly.
If nothing else, you're walking out with a skill. I think this is so important because I'm sure there's just so much content out there about embodiment. There's so much content out there about listen to your body. And even my statement about my values where I'm like, oh, my body will tell me. But yeah, if people aren't out of their head long enough to even listen to their body or be in their body, then this doesn't really matter. They're not going to understand that. They're not. I wrote an article the other day where last year I like finally fully understood the meaning of stopping and smelling the roses. Like I literally for the first time smelled spring in my neighborhood, you know? And it just showed how outside of my body I've been, how in my mind I've been, you know, throughout my whole life. So I think that it's fun. HR can be taxing sometimes. You know, you're dealing with a lot of different people, a lot of different problems. And so I imagine having this component of your business brings a lot of variety in your day-to-day work and is like something that's just super fun to do for yourself. And your proof, right, that you can have a hobby and a passion outside of work, such as dancing or singing or doing, you know, local plays or playing basketball with your friends, whatever that is, and be successful.
Yep.
Right. And run a successful business and however you're defining what success is. So you're proof that this happens. Like you have time. Have time to go do these things and they're actually better for you. And you can potentially make more money by doing these types of things and live longer, according to the studies that you've been looking at. So I'm going to pivot a little bit, and it's not going to be a happy one.
It's okay. Question. It's a needed one.
All HR people, I mean, LinkedIn is like on fire with SHRM, right? Yep. And it's very abundantly clear how most people feel about SHRM, or people who maybe don't feel the same way are just too scared to speak up. That could also be a thing too. I wanted to ask you this specifically because you've been in HR for so long. You've understood when SHRM was an amazing product, an amazing service, and now you've seen the evolution of SHRM, of what it's become today, per se, where even though I have experience in HR, I'm gonna be honest, I never liked SHRM. I never bought into their shit. I never got their certifications. Like I don't know what it was, but by the time I got into HR, SHRM was just boring, to be honest. Like I didn't want to go to their conferences. I think I'm probably even more of a CEO archetype than like an HR archetype. And so it just never really appealed to me. But somebody like you who's been close to them and utilized them, talk to me about how you're feeling about SHRM. Like, what do you think is going on? Is there a positive, you know, is there something positive coming from these changes that we're seeing in SHRM and kind of in the current administration as well? Like, what do you think is going to happen?
It's a big question. So you're not wrong in that I've seen it go from high value to low value. I remember getting my PHR in 1991. It was valuable to me at the time because, again, I didn't have a degree. Like, I couldn't get a degree in human resources. So my degree was in liberal arts. And for me to learn the nuances, SHRM was the outlet, right? So getting your PHR back then, this was before there was even an SPHR or a GPHR. This is like, you know, many people, I believe there might have been an SPHR. There definitely wasn't a GPHR. But, and there wasn't the California one. And I was living in California at the time because that's where I'm from originally. So the PHR helped me to understand more nuances, things around benefits, things around compliance, things that now you can go to really good seminars with Jackson Lewis and get a lot more data and actually get to talk to, you know, somebody who can give you insight, you know, getting into groups and communities that you can have just open conversations is way more valuable than the certification. And the certifications where they are now, just because I had mentioned that HR is so vast now, you're learning just little sound bites of a little bit of everything, right? And now that they've gone to this CPSCP, they've taken the global component and kind of sprinkled it into the CP and the SCP, which is a whole other animal. And so now you're learning little bits of more just to get a couple of letters. And honestly, it's just community. You know, it's like there are other communities out there that can give you a little bit more meat on the bones. And the one thing that I'd say a little bit too late, but hey, you know, it's because the market has other people out there offering it. They did start to add in individual certifications, right? So you can now get certified in some of those 26 specialties. But there's other people on the market now who also do that. So where they used to be the only game in town, that's not the case anymore. And I'd say that the last year, the ire for SHRM has ramped. Much of it has to do with leadership. Let's face it, as we're dealing with the United States, leadership, unfortunately, sometimes has the biggest bullhorn. And if you don't have a leader that aligns with your values and aligns with where you'd like to see your practice go, you're not going to listen to that leader anymore. So I think the shift in leadership is to the detriment of SHRM. And the area that I remember SHRM taking the lead where an individual really didn't have that opportunity was in lobbying, is being in DC and bringing forth the importance of human resources and being a part of adding information or adding review of potential bills, right? And being able to see how the collective, through the efforts of SHRM, helped to create practice and policy on a nationwide level. And then on a local level, this is probably the only saving grace. If you've got an amazing local chapter, then you can see benefit of community. You can see direct benefit of community. You can be around people who are going to help mentor you and who are going to be your sounding boards. So the local components, I think, are like the last hope for SHRM. And again, because they're the behemoth in the room right now, they tend to always have people joining local chapters. But I don't know how sustainable it's going to be with the everybody using Slack or WhatsApp or what have you. You know, there's other ways to get community and sounding boards and, you know, going to seminars to learn what you need to learn, as opposed to going to a SHRM conference, which is primarily just a bunch of booths, people selling things to you.
Yeah. Thank you for giving me that opinion or that perspective. Yeah, it's just on fire, it feels like, on LinkedIn. And that could just be because of the people I tend to be connected with. But, you know, we are seeing this launch, this kind of ramping up of different communities and different ways that HR professionals can connect. And, you know, I just always thought it was interesting that, you know, women take up 70% of the HR professional roles, and yet the CEO of SHRM was not a woman. I always found that interesting. But anyway, if you could give one piece of advice for HR leaders right now, something they could do right now to improve their own working experience and the work experience of their constituents of where they work, what would you say to them?
It's a good one. I have like a couple things in my mind. I think the first thing that's jumping to my head, so you always got to go with your intuition, is invest in yourself. Don't wait for somebody to invest in you. You're the only one who's going to know what you want, and you're the only one who's going to be able to enable that. You could solicit or recruit people to support you in that, but invest in yourself. Take time to figure out what it is that you really want to do. Too often I'm reading on the boards and in Facebook and what have you, and a lot of people are like, I'm burned out. I don't want to do HR anymore. Well, I just got done telling you there are 26 different certified disciplines and so many more. Don't give up on the practice altogether. I think maybe you just need to figure out what it is that you want. What component of HR aligns best with what you want and who you are? And again, that can change. Today, maybe it's X. Tomorrow, when you learn that skill, maybe it's Y. But I think the overwhelm is what causes most HR people, because as we've talked about ratios and we've talked about expansion and how it's shifted over 33 years and where you can honestly get support and how it's going to continue to evolve. We've talked about a lot. All of that requires you to do some internal work and figure out what it is that you want for yourself. And if you can't find it where you are, you could still stay there and get a paycheck and work on it elsewhere. But yeah, that would be probably my first piece of advice.
I love it. That's great advice. Yeah. What does success look like to you? You know, and just make sure that the way you're measuring success, you actually have control over achieving that success and not, you know, leaving it to the CEO or whoever, you know, to yeah. provide that for you.
Do not look for others. They're never going to give it to you fully.
Yeah. And then honestly, because they just don't know. They don't know what HR is supposed to be doing anyway. Carol, where can listeners find you?
You can find me on my website, c4talent.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, Carol Fraser. And my handle is Awesome HR Exec. And I've had that one for a long time. And you can find me on all social media. Right now, my social media might be slanted a little political, but hey, you know, it is what it is living in the United States.
It's who you are. That's all that matters. And, you know, if people feel some kind of way about it, then that's okay. Then they won't work with you. And I think yeah. that's fine. Yeah. Thank you for being here. You're I love that. A awesome HR exec. And here I am with HR sucks. Like, you're just way more sophisticated than I am. I really appreciate you being here. I'm actually in New York in a couple of months. I tend to be out there multiple times a year because of like conferences and different things that are going on. So I'm definitely going to hit you up, and hopefully we can have coffee or lunch together so we can meet in person and I get to see your beautiful purple hair in person. I'm only saying that in case people are only listening, because yeah. HR people are cool. Okay, we can
be
cool
too. I am covered in tattoos. I have flaming pink purple hair. It's just... I'm a normal, as I said to my client when they said, oh no, you hired somebody for HR. My reply back to everybody on Slack was, I guarantee you, I'm going to say fuck before all of you.
We should have a competition of who's going to say it first, because that's definitely my issue. I was telling the kids yesterday, I was like, just for once in my life, I want to be described as like quiet. Just once. I can't keep my mouth shut for the life of me in most cases. But anyway, thank you for being here, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.